Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
We welcome you to Close Up Radio. This is your host, Jim Masters. It's a pleasure to have you with us. We hope you had a beautiful Memorial Day weekend, and we're back in action here live with our broadcast series. It's a pleasure to have you here. It's also a pleasure to have Theodore Phelps with us as well. This is part one of an exclusive Close Up Radio two-part series. Ted is a seasoned CPA and private investigator serving as the president of FVLS Consultancy, renowned as a thought leader in his field. Theodore has dedicated over 40 years to unearthing fraud and upholding financial integrity. As his role as a forensic accountant, he brings a wealth of expertise to investigate a wide range of financial misconduct, including fraud, embezzlement, money laundering, and other unethical or illegal transactions. He extends the forensic evaluation litigation services to clients working closely with their legal teams, from securities fraud and insurance claims to motor vehicle accidents, bribery. The landscape of financial deception is broad and ever-changing. And in this era, the need for adept forensic accountants is more pressing than ever. As scams and identity theft become increasingly sophisticated, no platform, not even social media, is immune. It's hurting the ground of modern con artists, or hunting the ground, hurting us, but hunting that ground of modern con artists who devise new and more elaborate schemes each day to defraud us. Backed by more than 40 years of experience, he collaborates with his clients, not just as a forensic accountant, but as a trusted ally. Together, they forge the most effective strategies to untangle their financial challenges, whether it's orchestrating investigations, scrutinizing financial data, or guiding them towards the wisest courses of action. His commitment truly is to safeguard the interests with unwavering dedication, the interests of his clients. It's crucial for all to be vigilant, he says, as fraud can be profound and have a profound impact on both our personal and professional lives. He urges everyone to not delay in seeking the expertise of a forensic accountant, just like Ted, when you sense things are not adding up. It's our pleasure for part one of a two-part series to welcome Theodore Phelps of FVLS Consultancy, based in Spokane, Washington, here to Close Up Radio. Theodore, thank you very much for joining us here on the program. It's a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's our pleasure, and it's a really fascinating topic, and I'm really looking to dive in deep here with part one for the next 30 minutes uninterrupted of our two-part series. Initially, what inspired you, Ted, to want to get into this line of work? What was it about this that you were curious about, that inspired you, that pointed you in the direction of wanting to be a forensic accountant?
Well, I started out in my consulting career working with bankrupt and insolvent companies. And over the years working with these types of companies, I ran into fraud in many forms. And it was fascinating to me how, number one, how creative some of these people could be. And number two, just how gullible their victims were. And so as I evolved in my consulting practice, I started looking more toward fraud detection and prevention as opposed to reacting to it once I found it.
That's fantastic. That's great work that you do. Tell us about your role as a forensic accountant, some of the incredible work you do.
Well, I might... In most of the cases I get these days, I'm hired by an attorney for one of the parties in a litigation. to maybe value a business in a, in say a divorce or a partnership dispute. And in doing that, and in looking at the financial information that I have to use to perform that valuation, I'll find things that don't make sense. For example, large amounts of money being paid out to vendors that it just doesn't make sense that they can't have the kind of vendors that they do, and they're different than from the history of the company. So maybe I'll go to a database and investigate the ownership of that vendor, and lo and behold, it'll turn out that it's owned by one of the other partners in the business. And so they're basically paying money out to this company, this shell company, to reduce the value of the company that they're going to have to buy out my client. So that's one of the many ways that they can do that. Other ways is they'll pay personal expenses through the company. And even though a lot of people do that in their companies, it's if they try to conceal it that it becomes fraud.
It goes into another level. Tell us about some of the examples of the work in action, some of the examples of where forensics accounting is actually applied and used.
Okay. Well, first off, forensic accounting is accounting that will be used in court. Forensic means it's used or usable in court. So one case that I had not too long ago was a life settlement company. This is one of these companies that buys life insurance policies from people who are nearing the end of their lives and they need cash. And so they'll go in and buy these policies, and it's a tremendously profitable business. Well, my client had been ill for a while, and his two partners decided to force him out of the company. So they got a valuation by a large international accounting firm, but obviously limited the scope of the investigation, and they valued my client's interest at $35,000. We got in there and found that they had literally been moving tens of millions of dollars out of the company to these other vendors. And when we added it back and went through the process of valuing the company based on the adjusted income, we came up with a value of about $14 million. And, of course, it was so far different. But Case, after it went to trial with the value of his share in the company and wages that had not been paid and various other things, the verdict in my client's favor was $21 million. So we
wow.
consider that a real success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds exactly like a success to me. That's incredible. Tell us about the early career. And, you know, you mentioned some of the things that pointed you in the direction of doing the work. How has the career prior sort of enhanced maybe the work that you're doing today?
Well, basically, for the first 9 years of my working career, I worked in corporate accounting as a controller or VP of finance. And I kind of got a taste for working with financially distressed companies. And as the CFO of one, we did kind of a spectacular turnaround, and that got me a lot of publicity and a lot of good feelings. So in 1985, I started a consulting firm, basically doing workouts and turnarounds. And I did this for a period of years. And in 1989, Price Waterhouse, that's before they were PricewaterhouseCoopers, bought my practice, and I went to work for them as their director of corporate reorganization. And I was there to build a practice in the debtor side of bankruptcy and reorganization. And while I was there, I was attached to a group of people that did forensic accounting and business valuation and damage modeling. And it was very interesting to me. So about 2.5 years later, when I left them and reestablished my consulting practice, I added those disciplines as well. And now we're talking about the early 90s. And toward the end of that decade, I started doing receiverships, where a court would appoint me to go in and take over a failing or struggling business and either turn it around or liquidate it or sell it. And in all of those, there was a common thread of fraudulent behavior that would pop up. And so forensic accounting is part of the toolkit that I brought to every type of engagement.
That's really amazing. It's fascinating work that you do. Why do you feel marital and business partners splitting up are similar, and why has it become your mission to work specifically with this group?
Well, there are similarities because there are feelings of betrayal. There is anger. The parties feel, the parties either in a business dispute or in a marital dispute, feel fully justified in hiding information from the other side, and because they think that they're going to get shafted in court. And we run into a lot of the same kinds of things. We'll have a doctor, for example, who is trying to shield the value of his practice from being assigned to the spouse in the divorce action. And so that person might divert profits from the practice into premarital assets. For example, the building that was acquired prior to the marriage that the practice exists in and works out of. And so they might, in preparation for the divorce, double the rent for a few years prior to the divorce being filed. And of course, we have to look at the value of the building and look at what similar rentals are going for in that area to determine whether the rents are fair or not, or whether the excess rent has to be added back to the value of the practice. In a similar situation, when business partners are in disputes, you usually have a partner who is in control of the books and records, and that partner will deny access to the other partner to the books and records, or give them only spoon feed them information that they want them to have. And again, they can set up vendors that are in reality just themselves and divert money out of the business, because value of a business is determined by two things, cash flow and a risk rate. And so if you can decrease the cash flow, you're decreasing the value of the business. And so they will do everything they possibly can to decrease the cash flow and thereby reduce the value of the business and what their buyout is when they split up.
Again, it really takes an expert like you to be able to sort of decipher all of this, especially when you have marital and business partners splitting up, there's a lot of emotion that is oftentimes wrapped up in that, and that can blur things for the parties involved, right?
Yes, and again, in those two particular situations, people feel entirely justified in doing things to, quote, protect themselves that they would never do in ordinary circumstances. It's the pressure of the emotions, the feeling of betrayal, the uncertainty of going to court. All of this contributes to a breakdown in the underlying morality of the person or the group, and it and again, they feel entirely justified in doing these things. So you have a double battle there. Ordinarily, when you're dealing with people that know they're doing something wrong, they're a little more vulnerable than people that feel entirely justified. So it's a more challenging situation in many cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's got to be very challenging on so many different levels. Do you see fraud on the rise? And if so, why do you see it on the rise? Are people panicking? Is it, you know, the economy, inflation, just the pandemic, everything? Or what's you're on the ground level. What do you see happening?
Yeah, I grew up in the 50s, so I've got a kind of a wide perspective on this. I think that people have lost a feeling of accountability to a higher power, and I think that they, along with the culture itself, which began to change in the 60s, and in this, and especially in the 70s, you had, you know, in prior days we had heroes, and then we went to the anti-hero, and now we're with the hero villain. I remember
the
TV series Dallas, and it was cute for JR to go out and cheat his partners and cheat on his wife and all of this. And I think a lot of that is coming out. And the other thing is that technology has made fraud so easy. You don't have to trace a signature on a check anymore. You just scan it with your telephone and then put it onto a check that you don't even have to have the company's check. You can if you know their account numbers, you can make up your own check with the magnetic striping and everything on it. So there are technology has made fraud so much easier. And I think that combined with just a breakdown in moral education over the last 50 years has contributed a great deal to fraud being on the rise. Plus, it's a very organized effort in many cases. These denial of service and ransomware attacks, they're backed by governments in many cases. So, you know, we have much more formidable enemies than we did in the past.
Right, exactly, on so many different levels. How do you distinguish yourself from others that do the kind of work that you do, Ted?
Well, I think the breadth of my experience, the fact that I'm a licensed private investigator, so I have access to resources that straight-up CPAs don't have, and I come from that discipline as well, so I'm approaching it from two different directions, and I think that that gives me an edge over other CPAs who are just looking at it from the accounting in point.
Right, exactly. You have that extra added background. Technology, like you're saying, maybe we can expand on that. You touched upon it just a little bit, how it has made things more prevalent. You don't have to have necessarily the signature, things of that nature. It's made it overall more difficult to sort of work with, or are you able, as the expert, to use technology to your advantage in sort of dissecting and figuring these things out?
Well, we certainly do use technology. We have, in many cases, larger cases, we might get 50 or 100,000 documents to have to go through very quickly. And we use various technologies to pick up on keywords so that we don't have to read every single document and find that. We also, as a receiver, I have subpoena power, so we can go in and subpoena bank documents directly. We had one case a number of years ago where we found that the bank statements that the company was using to prepare their financial statements and to make reports to their customers and shareholders, that they had actually changed the totals on the bank statements themselves using Photoshop or similar technology, where they were inflating the balances of their bank accounts by 10 times. They turn a $1 million balance into $10 million or even more. So, again, as technology becomes more creative and more all-encompassing, the talents of these fraudsters are keeping right up with it. And with artificial intelligence becoming a bigger factor, I expect that they're going to be using that a great deal more.
Tell us about your work, Ted, as well as an expert witness. That's fascinating as well.
Okay. Well, our work is prepared in most cases for use in a lawsuit. And as an expert witness is different than what they call a percipient or a fact witness. A fact witness can testify only to things that he or she knows and can't render an opinion. An expert is a person who's qualified by the court to come in and render opinions. And the purpose for an expert is to assist the court or the trier of fact. The trier of fact is either a judge in a bench trial or a jury in a jury trial, to assist them in understanding complex matters that most ordinary people don't understand as a matter of course. So, as an expert, I prepare a report and I submit it. And the first part of that is to be deposed or have the other side ask questions about my report and in what's called a deposition. And that's the first part of your expert testimony. Now, luckily, I think most of my cases settle at that stage. The other experts give their opinions, and then the attorneys get together, and most of the time they're going to settle the case. I think only 3% of civil litigation actually goes to trial. But in the event that it does go to trial and they can't settle, then I will go in and sit in the witness box and raise my right hand, and I will testify the results of my examination or my engagement. And then I'll be cross-examined by the other side. And, of course, that's where the rubber meets the road, is surviving cross-examination, because you get some very smart people on the other side. You never want to underestimate the other side.
Exactly right. On every level imaginable, absolutely. Tell us maybe some ways that the public can help to fight cybercrime, just being vigilant, you know, making sure we change our passwords and all these other things, don't open emails that are strange, and a lot of the things we're always hearing. Overall, what are some things that the public can do? Because that's on the rise dramatically, cybercrime.
It is, and watch what you click. I get them all every day, text messages and emails that ask you to click on a link. And if you don't know who it's coming from or why you're getting it, don't click on it. Just put it directly to trash. If people really need to get hold of you, they can send you an email without links in it, or they can call you on the phone. Nothing you get in email is so important that you have to click on an unfamiliar link, because all it takes is that one click and they can compromise virtually everything on your computer.
It really is scary stuff. It is tremendous. You know, you can lock your windows and your doors. You can gate your home and have a moat with alligators around your house. That doesn't matter if you're skimming through the internet and you're not being, you know, protective. The, you know, situations can happen within your four walls, as many people realize. This is, again, part one of our two-part series, and more can be shared on the next episode. But what would be maybe a high-profile case of fraud, perhaps some of the ones that would be notable?
I'm not going to quote names, but we did a Ponzi scheme case a few years back where we were actually working for a federal receiver, and I think it ended up involving about $500 million in 36 different companies, and we had to go in and assemble all of these companies and figure out just exactly what this person was doing. But he was selling investment opportunities to investors who weren't terribly discerning in where they put their money, and had cheated them out of several hundred million dollars. And this was this down in Orange County, California. That was about 10 years ago.
That's something, huh? It's, you know, just never realize what's happening. This really is fascinating, Ted, on so many different levels. And again, I know it's very intense work, and there's a lot of study and tenacity involved in doing this work. And again, you've been doing this for a long time, and you have a real passion for it. Thanks for stopping by the show for part one. Again, we look forward to part two coming up on Tuesday, June 6th. If folks want to make contact and learn more about FVLS Consulting and the work that you do, of course, they can go to the website FVLSC.com. That's FVLSC.com. to learn more and to connect with Theodore Phillips and the team. This was really terrific. Really appreciate all the time, and looking forward to part two coming up on
Thanks,
June
Jim.
6th. Thank you for all that you do as well, Ted, and enjoy the rest of your day, and thanks for stopping by Close Up Radio. You take care now, okay?
Bye.
Again, everybody, if you'd like to learn more, FVLSC.com is the website. Theodore Phelps, seasoned CPA, private investigator, president of FVLS Consultancy, our guest. Jim Masters thanking you for your time this time. Till next time, we hope you enjoyed this episode, and stay right there. Another great guest coming up in Close Up Radio in just a minute. Till then, for all of us, have a great day. Bye for now.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.